Important safety information will be available for Small Flippid at the end of this discussion.
I'd like to welcome Andrew Mays with me today. He's a clinical pharmacy specialist, a PharmD in nutrition support from the University of Mississippi Medical Center, where he serves as leader of the institution's adult nutrition support service. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy, where he assists in providing nutrition support education. Dr. Mays graduated from the University of Mississippi with his PharmD and MBA. He completed an ASHP accredited PGY1 residency at North Mississippi Medical Center in Tupelo, Mississippi. And Dr. Mays is an active member of the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, or ASPEN, and he currently serves as chair of the Parenteral Nutrition Safety Committee, as well as co-chair of the ASPEN Conference Planning Committee. So thank you for joining me today, Andrew.
Thanks, Gordon. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I know today we were going to discuss a very important topic, and that's how to go through the process of getting nutrition products on an institution's formulary. And I know you went through a very systematic approach to do this at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and I thought your approach was great. And I'd like really for you to kind of share that process so that other people can learn from you what worked well, and then maybe what were some of the things to avoid or what were some pitfalls. So I'll just turn it back over to you.
Yeah, so our process is we treat all of our nutrition-related products just like a normal medication. So they will be reviewed by the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. They'll be submitted by a provider, or they can be submitted by the director of pharmacy for certain requests. So we kind of start out with looking for a problem, and is there a new therapy that we can use to address that problem? How will an innovation impact our patients and health system? I mean, even from an efficacy, a safety, or is there going to be a pharmacoeconomic impact on our health system? You know, we also want to look at supporting literature and, you know, how new is this literature? Is it practice changing? And look at that data to make sure that we're going to meet our intended indication and change in formulary. And then, can we ensure consistent adherence to the new medication or new added item? So how can we look for roadblocks and kind of think about the future to ensure appropriate utilization? So that's, you know, appropriate in both ways, right? Like over and under prescribing. We want the right patients to receive it, but we also don't want over prescribing. And then, you know, how can we get data together and present it to the appropriate group and just ensure that everybody involved hears the benefit of this product that we want to add and make sure that it's presented in a way that everybody can synthesize it, because it, you know, we have a pretty short time frame to present a lot of data to somebody that may not be an expert in nutrition. And so we try to condense it and make it as easy to read and understand as possible.
So with regards to parenteral nutrition, I think it's, and the various products, I think it's unique in that it spans across patient populations, adult and peds. And I know the University of Mississippi Medical Center has a pediatric hospital. When you went through this process, were you advocating for both the adults and peds, or was that a separate process for peds?
So initially it was just for adult, because this was right around the time that Small Flippid received the initial indication in adult patients. And then once the pediatric side of the hospital, you know, we have a level 4 NICU and quite a large PM population over there. They heard that we were using Small Flippid in our adult patients, and there was some interest there. So we initially went for the adult indication and then moved to pediatrics. And with the new recent approval, it made that transition even easier in our pediatric patients.
Okay. And I know, being a pharmacist myself, going through the P&T committee, is primarily a pharmacist-run type of process. But then once you get approval, there's a huge educational component that's involved. And certainly, I know you didn't do all the education on yourself and you enlisted other disciplines. I was wondering if you could kind of describe what was the type of logistics you went through from an educational standpoint, and who you included and what you felt really worked well in educating people about these products.
Yeah, so our dietitians were already aware of the novel ILEs. We also had a Megavin approved in our pediatric hospital before Smofflipid, before that indication came through the FDA, and started using Smofflipid over there. But so the dietitians were very aware of the product. I did kind of touch base with them to make sure that they, if they had any questions, that I could answer for them, and let them know that this would probably be going to Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to be approved for addition in certain patient populations, and that they would, you know, that would be something that they could start seeing as far as on our formulary. Actually, the director of clinical nutrition services comes to P&T when there are nutrition-related matters in our health system. So the review of the enteral formulary, other things like that, she will be there as well for that process. So the dietitians, that group is pretty easy. The nurses probably would, for us, we identified that as the biggest area for education. So they were completely used to Intralipid. You know, if they see the bag, they knew exactly what it would look like, but just the risk of the two products side by side in a nurse that may have a lot of patients, we just really educated them, like, these are two different things. You know, there are components that one patient could be allergic to, and the other patient, they may receive the other lipid and it would be fine. We let them know that we would treat it as a lipid as we did before, as far as filtering and things like that. And so we actually went before our nursing leadership, that the nursing directors, and let them know. And then that was communicated to nurse managers and educators, and then to the frontline staff. And we've also utilized Epic and our EHR to help with some, not education, but notification to the nursing staff as well. Our providers were very on board with the change, just due to the data and everything that supports the use of novel ILEs. They were all on board with that, you know, no pushback or anything like that. I think the providers were happy to have another product that had literature to support it to put into everyday practice.
So you mentioned, it sounded like, when you talked about educating the nurses about that they're used to intralipid bags. So it sounds like you have a 2-in-1 delivery system at your institution. You don't use 3-in-1s, is that correct?
Correct, we still are a 2-in-1 hospital. So dextrose, amino acid, and then Y-side in our ILEs.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. And then I thought it was interesting in some of our discussions previous to this recording that you shared with me that even after you got the product on formulary, that there was a retrospective review of data afterwards, and that you reviewed kind of workflow gaps and collected data and then presented it to stakeholders afterwards. I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that process that you went through and how important that was to the stakeholders as well.
Yeah, so we really try to do this with all medications that are added to formulary. We would like to do a retrospective review to look at two cohorts, pre-implementation and post, not just from an outcomes perspective, but we also want to make sure that we are abiding by best practice for prescribing the new product. So we could do that a couple different ways in our institution. We would either do a medication use evaluation, our PGY1 residents take responsibility for those, or we could give it to one of our residents to do as a full IRB research project. So we actually took this implementation and one of our PGY1s did it for their research project. We really looked at a small subset of all the patients that received novel ILE in our adult patient population, and we looked at surgical trauma, critical care patients, and so looked at some of the outcomes and things that are shown in the literature. Just to look at our practice, we also looked at amounts of fat delivered, amounts of fish oil delivered, things like that. Then we also did a brief pharmacoeconomic review where we looked at comparison of just cost and things like that between our two groups.
And that's great. Thanks for sharing that. And as far as the stakeholders, who in particular made up this group as far as disciplines and maybe what some of their titles were?
Yeah, so we actually will present this whole review back to the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And so we have representation from just about every physician group in the hospital. Surgical trauma, critical care, pulmonary, medical ICU, just about every discipline within the hospital. We have some pediatric representation on there as well, 4 or 5 pediatric providers. And we have 2 medicine providers as well, so not so much specialty providers. And then we'll present it there, get feedback, and then we'll also present it to groups that we would see a high prescribing of PN specifically for this intervention. So surgical trauma, critical care, our trauma, ACS surgery, and then, you know, we have colorectal, hepatobiliary transplant surgery as well, and Surgeon, and they're very big users of our consult-based service. So we would show all that to them as well.
So that's a huge, diverse group that you were in front of. That's great. As far as in retrospect, as you look, having completed the process, is there anything that you would have done differently or wish or would have changed? Or do you think the process worked exactly as you wanted it to?
With new items when we add in the formulary, I feel like we have most of the process down where we can implement it pretty quickly, have it built in our EHR, utilize our EHR to the best of its ability. And then it's really like feet on the ground as far as education and making sure that nurses and everybody's comfortable with the new thing. This is a pretty large institution, and I kind of realized that when I came here. You know, you have 12,000 people that work here overall. There's just a huge population. The nursing staff may turn over a lot, so just always reinforcing education. And so once that initial education is done, you know, you may have half of the nursing staff on one of our surgical floors turnover. So always making sure the nurse educator is up to date with any changes, you know, the new filter recommendations, what's, you know, do we filter these lipids the same way, things like that, so that we can feel comfortable after the implementation. I felt pretty comfortable from an EHR standpoint. The workflow in pharmacy did get a little bit complicated because we wanted to minimize any mistake between intralipid and SMOF lipid. And so we actually sequester the SMOF lipid in a different area and label it with a medication alert sticker when it comes out of the box, so that when a technician pulls it, it'll have an alert on there too, just to kind of help a little bit with that process as well.
Okay. So I guess in summary, if you had to boil down like 3 to 4 takeaways and you were advising someone on how to navigate the process of adding a product, parenteral nutrition product to formulary, what would be your 3 to 4 takeaways?
I think number 1 would be work with all of your disciplines. If you're a dietitian, reach out to pharmacy, work with them, work with your providers, work as a group so that you all can all be on the same page and an initial group can have an understanding of what this product is going to do. So like all the benefits of SmofLipid, I have all of the studies and I put them into a small chart and provided that to that group and kind of had initial buy-in. Once you have that, then our process would just be to get a form approved and sent over to our P&T committee. And so I would say one would be initial work with a diverse group of healthcare professionals. Two would be make sure that you have, start working on education early and identify the group that you're going to have to educate the most and that are going to need continued education. It's not just from a nursing perspective. You know, pharmacy staff turns over as well. Your dietitians turn over as well. So you want everybody to be on the same page as far as what is on formulary, how do we use it in these patient populations. And so for an example would be when we opened up to pediatric SmofLipid, you know, that's a whole different area, a whole separate hospital in our system. We're just connected. And that's another large lift as far as education goes. So some dietitians may cover just outpatient, but if they had to cover inpatient, they would like to know, you know, what are your formulated lipids, emulsions. So education as a whole. And then I think three would be make sure that you have an idea of a process to go back and look at your implementation, look at adherence, look at outcomes, see what impact you made, and then look for issues within the process and fix those issues. And, you know, after that initial implementation, it may not go perfect initially, but you can always fix small little things that may help throughout the process from a workflow perspective to everybody and for people that prescribe the nutrition product.
Those are all great insights, and I really appreciate you sharing that with us and giving some tips to someone that would be having to navigate the adoption process for their formulary. So thanks a lot for sharing all your thoughts and advice today with everyone.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Next, I'd like to ask Dr. Mays to share a case with us with regards to a very interesting case about a patient undergoing a bone marrow transplant and what were some of the different clinical scenarios and issues that were encountered that required adjustments to the parenteral nutrition regimen. So Dr. Mays, what I'll do is ask you to read through the case and kind of take us through some of the issues that you encountered. And then at certain points, I may ask some questions or clarifications. So I'll turn it back to you.
Sure. So we have a 67-year-old male with a history of AML whose status post a bone marrow transplant with persistent diarrhea. The patient was actually found to have graft versus host disease on EGD and FlexSig a week after they had this persistent diarrhea, and they were worked up for other reasons for the diarrhea. So the patient has had no adequate oral intake and still with diarrhea. They've been started on high dose steroids to treat graft versus host disease. And they have a recent 10-pound weight loss over the last month. Their past medical history would be AML, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, GERD, dyslipidemia, and hypertension. Surgical history was just cataracts. Social history was negative for alcohol, tobacco, and illicits. Family history was diabetes, hypertension, stroke in one relative, and coronary artery. As of now, the patient initially, when I was consulted, was on methylprednisolone, 1.5 mg per kg IV daily, budesonide, 6 mg PO daily, mycophenolate 500 milligrams PO BID, pantoprazole 40 milligrams PO daily, posaconazole 200 milligrams PO TID, and sertraline 50 milligrams oral daily. This patient was 60 inches tall, had a weight of 50 kilograms, and had a BMI of 21.52. So we are a 2-in-1 hospital or a dextrose amino acid admixture with a separate ILE infusion wide in. Our initial goal for our PN formula was 15 kcals per day or 30 kcals per kilogram per day with a goal protein of 90 grams per day or 1.8 grams per kilo per day to provide 360 kcals per day. Our lipids, we initially used soy-based ILE, 20 grams, so 100 ml bag of 20% soy ILE to provide 200 kcals per day. And our dextrose goal was 276 grams per day to provide 940 kcals per day. And that provides 3.8 mgs per kg per minute of dextrose. Baseline labs, glucose was 240. Sodium was 139, potassium was 3.9, magnesium was 2.1, phosphorus was 3.5, and the triglycerides were 205.
Great. And so, you know, with the baseline labs, obviously the thing that jumps out to me is the glucose. You know, some people would say the triglycerides are slightly high, but the glucose and then the patient being on methylprednisolone probably contributed to that. What is your thought process then at this point about how you want to maybe adjust your parenteral nutrition formulation to address some of the issues?
Yes. So day one, I'm going to initiate at 100 grams per day of dextrose, just based off of risk for refeeding for this patient with the recent weight loss. And I obviously don't want to cause any more hyperglycemia. I also like to look at their home insulin regimen and see if they're on, you know, oral anti-diabetic medications or a subcutaneous insulin regimen at home, so I can get an idea. You do have to remember those patients will eat way differently at home compared to when you're controlling them in the hospital and giving them an exact amount of dextrose, whether that's orally or carbohydrates orally, or if you're giving dextrose IV or via tube feeds. So I really initially went with kind of our normal 0.1 unit per gram of dextrose, which was 10 units of insulin per that initial bag to start out with in this patient.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. And then it looks like you then obtained some additional labs and you have some additional point of care glucose values. If you go ahead and share those with everybody and what your thought process was after seeing those labs.
Yeah, so after that initial day, that day one of PN, their serum glucose elevated to 318. Sodium was 141, potassium was 4, magnesium was 2, and phosphorus was 3.3. Their point of care glucoses, when I look at these, I also think, you know, there is some variance between serum and point of care, but those are as follows: 240, 235, 245, and 303, as far as in order of chronological order, with 303 being the most recent. And that patient received 24 units of correctional insulin. So my thought process is they're still on steroids. I'm not so worried about the budesonide oral because the absorption is pretty minimal, but the IV methylprednisolone, it is obviously one of the big reasons why. So I went ahead and increased the insulin in the PN bag to 25 units per bag based on that 24 units of correctional. I like to take about half of that and add it back to the bag. So I went from 10 units to 25 units.
Okay. And then you know, as we know that when the patient is getting so much insulin that it could affect some other electrolytes, potentially shifting intracellular shift, I was wondering if you could kind of share your thought process about that and maybe anticipating some electrolyte abnormalities as a result of that.
Yeah, a pretty big, I mean, 15 units is a pretty, not a super large increase, but it's a decent increase in insulin that you're putting in a bag the patient's going to receive. And, you know, I kind of preemptively start thinking about, you know, how is potassium going to shift? Is MAG going to deplete as well? You know, what's going to happen there? And I'm obviously not going to change my dextrose amount provided right now. I'm going to get glycemic control before I address dextrose advancement.
And in your mind, that's a great point that you don't want to advance the parenteral nutrition formulation. Do you have a cutoff? Maybe would you like to see your point of care glucose is below a certain level before advancing?
I'm comfortable in the low 200s, so 200 to 230. I'm pretty comfortable with that on point of cares. If I would like my serum to be less than 200, I try to abide by the ADA standards of care as much as possible. But if I'm comfortable in the low 200s and I can advance a little bit dextrose and also increase my insulin, I feel comfortable there. It just kind of depends on the patient too.
Okay. All right. So take us through then the next couple of days of PN and what you were seeing and what were some of the major changes that you were making.
Yeah. So the day after the increase in regular insulin in the bag to 25 units per bag, remember the dextrose stays the same. Serum glucose was 234, sodium was 140, potassium 3.7, magnesium 1.5, phosphorus 2.9. And our point of care glucose is 230, 246, 342, and 305. And the patient received 28 units of correctional insulin from those point of care glucoses. So you did see a little bit of drop of the K and MAG, their FOS as well. So as far as my electrolytes, I went ahead and bolus potassium phosphate and magnesium, increased the potassium phosphate and magnesium in the bag. And I went ahead and increased the insulin from 25 units to 35 units per bag. Because I also think about with these point of cares, I also look at when they occurred, right? So our hang time is 1800. I really don't care about glucose. Well, I care about them. I'm not going to see the impact of the new PN bag until after 1800. So those are really where I start to like look and see what my previous days of PN prescription did for the patient moving forward. So that was day two. On day three, remember the patient still has not had their dextrose advanced at all. This PN had 35 units of insulin per bag. Their serum glucose was still elevated. It was 310. Their sodium was 141. Their potassium actually dropped further to 3.5 from 3.7. Their magnesium, 1.9. Their phosphorus, 3.2. With their point of cares, they looked worse. 308, 280, 312, and 290. And so the steroids have not changed for this patient. Still the same amount, and the patient received 30 units of correctional insulin. So I went ahead and increased the potassium phosphate and magnesium in the bag and increased the insulin to 50 units. So half of 30 is 15 units, and I went from 35 to 50 for that day. So day four, 50 units of insulin in the bag. Our serum glucose is a little bit better. It was 275. Our electrolytes do look better. Potassium 4, magnesium 2.1, phosphorus 3.9. Our point of cares are all under 300, 284, 248, 275, and 265. And the patient received 21 units of correctional insulin. Steroid dose still has not changed. And then you know, I'm kind of thinking about what can I do with my PN formulation. I'm going to have a lot of problems, I feel like, with this patient if I'm trying to get to his goal dextrose that I initially wanted to prescribe, which is 276 per day. So I went ahead and increased potassium phosphate and magnesium in the PN bag, increased the insulin from 50 units to 65 units per bag. And I went ahead and increased the dextrose towards goal a little bit. I went from 100 to 200. I was kind of brave and see what would happen with this patient. Usually I will do a proportion. If I have some glycemic control with a certain proportion of insulin to dextrose grams, I will kind of carry that over to the bag when I advance it. So the next day, with that advancement in the dextrose, with 65 units in the bag, their serum glucose was 295, sodium 144, potassium 3.5, magnesium 1.7, and phosphorus 3. I also followed up with the serum triglyceride, and it was 395. Our point of care glucoses are as follows: 308, 295, 305, and 280. And the patient actually received 30 units of correctional insulin. Still no change for the steroids for the graft versus host disease. So this is where I'm really, it's like, I don't think I'm going to be able to ever achieve glycemic control in this patient. You know, what can I do to my PN formulation to maybe help with that and still provide calories, but not give so much dextrose?
At what point do you think about, you know, starting an insulin drip and trying to control the blood sugars on the outside of the bag? Did that come up in your plan?
Yes. Well, this patient, our bone marrow transplant unit does not allow insulin infusion. So if they were in the ICU, we would have started them on an insulin infusion initially. Sometimes we will give a little bit of subcutaneous long-acting insulin, especially in our diabetics that have pretty strong diabetic history for type 2. When they receive steroids and if they're on PN, we may give a little bit of glargine to kind of help with their baseline needs. But yeah, we couldn't do an infusion. It would have been nice though.
Okay. So really the only option, kind of like what you are getting at and what you did, was trying to change the lipid component, so then that will allow you to lower the dextrose as well.
Yeah, so my plan was really, can I safely give more lipids? Can I look at a novel ILE product at an increased dose? Will they tolerate that increased dose? And their triglycerides were a little elevated. So that's one reason why I was like, well, hopefully we will have be tolerated better with the 4-oral ILE and the components within that 4-oral ILE if we give an increased dose of that lipid. And we can just see how that goes moving forward. So my plan was, you know, keep the protein the same, keep our calories the same, but increase our ILE from 20 grams to 50 grams of 4-oral ILE and reduce our dextrose. So we were able to bring down our goal dextrose by, you know, a decent amount, down to 188 grams per day, down from 276. So that brought it down to 2.6 milligram per kilogram per minute of dextrose as far as a glucose infusion rate.
Okay. No, that seems reasonable. And then, so that was on day five.
Okay. Day five.
All right. So then kind of take us through what happened after that change.
Yeah. So I reformulated the PN. We still did protein 90 grams per day. The dextrose was 150 instead of 200, and our 4-oral ILE was 250 mils per day. This had 65 grams or 65 units of insulin in the bag. Our serum lab, as far as glucose, looked a lot better, 239 our sodium was 143, potassium 3.9, magnesium 2, and phosphorus 4. Our point of cares looked a lot better, 235, 248, 228, and 225. The patient did receive 20 units of correctional insulin. Steroids, as far as the methylprednisolone, still did not change. So, you know, my point of cares are in the lower 200s. My serum was 239. I feel pretty good about that. So I still increased the insulin in the bag from 65 units to 75 units, but I went ahead and increased to gold dextrose. Remember, we were at 150 in this new formulation for the first day on day five, but our target was 188. So, you know, pretty small bump, and I still increased the insulin in the bag as well. So day seven, we're at goal as far as our protein, dextrose, and ILE, so receiving goal calories. There's 75 units of regular insulin in the bag. Our serum glucose was 195 that morning, sodium 143, potassium 3.4, magnesium 1.7, and phosphorus 3.2. Our point of cares actually looked great, 180, 165, 175, 165, and the patient received 12 units of correctional, which is a great improvement. The steroids still did not change for graft-versus-host disease. I went ahead and bolused potassium phosphate and magnesium outside of the PN and went ahead and increased the KFOS and magnesium in the PN bag as well. So I continued the PN at goal calories and continued that regular insulin 75 units in the PN bag. I felt like control was adequate. So I wanted to see how the patient would progress and just follow the steroids and if they would eventually start an oral diet. So day eight still looked great. A glucose, serum glucose of 180, sodium 141, potassium 4.2, magnesium 2.1, and phosphorus 4. Our point of cares, 165, 145, 155, and 163. And the patient only received nine units of correctional insulin. And so I really didn't want to make any changes. I felt like they looked great. I continued the PN at the goal calories, continued the regular insulin in the PN of 75 units per bag. But I wanted to go ahead and recheck a serum triglyceride because this was day eight. And we had that elevation a few days before, so I just wanted to double check that. So coming back around, steroids were still continued before this day nine. Still remember 75 units of insulin in the bag. Serum glucose was 178, sodium was 142, potassium was 4.1, magnesium was 2, and phosphorus was 3.9. Our serum triglyceride came back as 250, so that's great. Our point of care glucose is 142, 155, 143, and 160. And the patient receives 6 units of correctional insulin based on our correctional scale here. So the plan after that was I was just going to kind of keep everything as I started. PN at goal KCAL, continue the 75 units of regular insulin in the bag, and just really watch and talk to the heme team. You know, when are you going to taper steroids? You know, what's our plan with those? And the patient ended up being started on a clear liquid diet, so I added some clear oral supplement to that as well, and just followed them after that.
And to clarify for people that may not be familiar with bone marrow transplant and graft versus host disease, as far as what the primary clinical manifestation of that is, could you share that and what potential that would have on electrolyte imbalances as well?
Yeah, so your primary thing would be really uncontrolled diarrhea. And usually these patients are worked up for for infectious causes, and they don't have infectious causes. They have graft versus host disease. And you can see that esophageal, and you can see that in your bowel as well, in the colon. That's why they had a flex sig and an EGD. And as far as electrolytes, I've actually had other patients that had really, really, really bad graft versus host disease, had rectal tubes, and they were also on amphotericin. And so they were just wasting potassium left and right. It was just, you could not keep up with their potassium needs. It was pretty rough.
Yeah, those are tough patients. Well, that was a great case. And I think you really highlighted that. I think a major turning point was when we're able to show that you couldn't really push on the dextrose, that really the only way was to look at kind of rejuggling the various components and being able to use a lipid that allowed you to lower your glucose infusion rate, I think was really beneficial. And then it also had helped address the triglyceride level, and it actually lowered. So I think that's really an important point to bring out. Any other key takeaways that you'd like to share with everyone before we close?
We've used SMOFlipid in our bone marrow transplant unit for quite some time now. And all of our patients have tolerated it very well. So we're really happy with that. And you just have to think outside of the box sometimes. I tell that to residents and trainees, you know, whoever it may be. Sometimes you have to stop and take a minute and think how, instead of maybe just ramping way up on insulin, like how can you kind of rethink things and be creative to make sure your patient receives what they need from a therapeutic standpoint.
I would agree totally. Thanks again for sharing this excellent case and bringing out some very important teaching points. And hopefully we'll catch up with you in the future, and you'll be able to share some other tips with us. So thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Indications and usage. SMOFlipid is indicated in adult and pediatric patients, including term and preterm neonates, as a source of calories and essential fatty acids for parenteral nutrition, PN, when oral or enteral nutrition is not possible, insufficient, or contraindicated. Important safety information. For intravenous infusion only into a central or peripheral vein, use a non-vented, non-DEHP 1.2 micron inline filter set during administration. Recommended dosage depends on age, energy expenditure, clinical status, body weight, tolerance, ability to metabolize and eliminate lipids, and consideration of additional energy given to the patient. The recommended dose for adults and pediatrics is shown in Table 1. For information on age-appropriate infusion rate, see the full prescribing information. SMOFlipid Pharmacy Bulk Package is only indicated for use in pharmacy admixture programs for the preparation of 3-in-1 or total nutrition admixtures. Protect the admixed PN solution from light. Table 1 recommended adult and pediatric dosage. Age, birth to 2 years of age, including preterm and term neonates. Nutritional requirements, initial recommended dosage, 0.5 to 1 gram per kilogram per day. Maximum dosage, 3 grams per kilogram per day. Pediatric patients, 2 to less than 12 years of age, 1 to 2 grams per kilogram per day, and maximum dosage, 3 grams per kilogram per day. Pediatric patients, 12 to 17 years of age, 1 gram per kilogram per day, with a maximum dosage of 2.5 grams per kilogram per day. Adults, 1 to 2 gram per kilogram per day, maximum dosage 2.5 grams per kilogram per day. SMOFlipid is contraindicated in patients with known hypersensitivity to fish, egg, soybean, peanut, or any of the active or inactive ingredients, and severe disorders of lipid metabolism characterized by hypertriglyceridemia, serum triglycerides greater than 1,000 milligrams per deciliter. Clinical decompensation with rapid infusion of intravenous lipid emulsion in neonates and infants. Acute respiratory distress, metabolic acidosis, and death after rapid infusion of intravenous lipid emulsions have been reported. Parenteral nutrition-associated liver disease. Increased risk in patients who received parenteral nutrition for greater than 2 weeks, especially preterm neonates. Monitor liver tests. If abnormalities occur, consider discontinuation or dosage reduction. Hypersensitivity reactions. Monitor for signs or symptoms. Discontinue infusion if reactions occur. Risk of infections, fat overload syndrome, refeeding syndrome, hypertriglyceridemia, and essential fatty acid deficiency. Monitor for signs and symptoms. Monitor laboratory parameters. aluminum toxicity, increased risk in patients with renal impairment, including preterm neonates. Most common adverse drug reactions greater than or equal to 5% from clinical trials in adults were nausea, vomiting, and hyperglycemia. Most common adverse drug reactions greater than or equal to 5% from clinical trials in pediatric patients were anemia, vomiting, increased gamma-glutamyl transferase, and nosocomial infection. To report suspected adverse reactions, contact Fresenius Kabi USA, LLC at 1-800-551-7176, option 5, or FDA at 1-800-FDA-1088, or www.fda.gov/medwatch. This important safety information does not include all the information needed to use small flipids safely and effectively. Please see full prescribing information for intravenous use at www.fresenius-kabi-nutrition.com.